guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
that guitar
three.
Up.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century look at history's greatest rock albums. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's two mid-70s underappreciated Doobie Brothers albums, Vices and Habits and Stampede. By the time the Doobie Brothers' fourth album, What Were Once Vices Are Now Habits, was released in early 1974, their third album, The Captain and Me, a year earlier, had proven that 1972's To Loose Street and the hit Listen to the Music were no flukes. The Captain and Me generated two huge hits in Long Train Runnin' and China Grove, and the Doobie Brothers went from bars in their native San Jose and San Francisco Bay Area to theaters and small halls across America. Doobie Brothers singer, songwriter, guitarist Tom Johnston was with me in the studio.
Everything's going pretty fast by then. We were on the road so much. If we were on the road, we were in the studio. You didn't have much time at home, so it's going by. I don't know what it was. It's like we wanted to. We considered ourselves a rock band. You know, I mean, we became more so, if anything. And a lot of us had come from backgrounds of playing power trios and things like that. And we wanted, and that's the way we came across live on stage, except for the acoustic numbers that would be done, and the softer numbers. But when we rock and roll, we would rock and roll hard. And people were surprised by that. I know I've been told several times by people that they'd heard, say, To Loose Street, or even The Captain and Me, and they went to see us live. They thought we were a good group, but they didn't expect to get the show that they got. And somehow it just never got translated. That energy never really got translated to record until maybe Vices and Habits.
Thank you.
The Doobie Brothers with Another Park, Another Sunday from the 1974 album What Were Once Vices Are Now Habits. It was chosen by the Doobie Brothers record company as the first single from the album, but stalled out at only number 32. One of the notable new musical flavors introduced on the Vices Habits album was reeds and horns, introduced to Tom Johnston when he was just a schoolboy.
I started playing clarinet when I was 8 years old, and I hated the damn thing, and I didn't want to play it. I wanted to play a trumpet, and they said, no, you're going to play a clarinet. So that's how that went. And I ended up playing sax in junior high and high school, and I wished I'd have kept playing sax. I enjoyed the saxophone a lot. It was a lot of fun to play. I played in the jazz bands and stuff. But I can't read a note of music now as a result of my feelings for the clarinet in particular. You can't be a hood and play clarinet in the high school marching band. It just doesn't gel, you know. And I was trying to hang around these guys who were pretty much what they called hoods in those days, and I wasn't really a hood, per se, but I hung around with some of the people that were. And I couldn't rebel with that. That's what the guitar was so good for. We also used different horn sections on albums. We used White Trash's horn section on Toulouse Street. We didn't use any horns on Captain and Me. The following album, we used Memphis horns. And we used, on one song on the following album, we used a guy who just got out of prison named James Booker, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, but he was a good blues player out of New Orleans. And he got finished and he went right back to prison. So that was that.
Absolutely infectious combination, the Doobie Brothers plus the Memphis horns on Eyes of Silver. Despite the seemingly unstoppable groove, the record company's second single stopped at a disappointing number 52 chart position. The Allman Brothers Band and the Grateful Dead were fairly famous for employing two tandem drummers, but the original Doobie Brothers did it as well. The late Doobie drummer Mike Hossick tried to explain, in layman's terms to me, where that joyous funk, exemplified in Eyes of Silver, came from.
I think it's all stems from that Alan Toussaint, the Nevilles, the Meters, and Dr. John, all that kind of second line. It's that second line. It's a growth from that second line New Orleans kind of beat, a growth out of that kind of music. And, you know, I mean, Working in the Coal Mine, all those kind of songs. I enjoyed those as a younger person, and I think that kind of music is appealing to not just musicians, but you know, just a large cross section of people.
I wrote about the South a lot. Maybe it's because a lot of my folks are from the South, and the other thing is the South's real colorful. It's easy to write songs about the South. There's always something that you can latch on to. I don't care what area. It doesn't have to be New Orleans. It can be. I wrote songs about Texas. I wrote songs about Tennessee. I wrote songs about all over the place. I don't know why. There's a link there that seems to be strong throughout the history of my songwriting anyway. And I don't necessarily know exactly why. Other than I was brought up in a town that's full of, or at least back then, was full of a lot of people whose origins were from the South, including mine. So it's like there was a link there. And I would go back to the section of Missouri I did over several times, you know, as I was growing up and, you know, still have. And that was considered part of the South during the Civil War and all that. And I went down and saw a lot of places and did, you know, like St. Genevieve, you know, like that. And Savannah, Georgia, going to New Orleans, going to places in Texas, going to places, you know, all over, you know. And they're colorful places to write about. And the way people lived were colorful things to write about. And the imagery in the South is kind of grand and yet at the same time, folksy. And Little Feat did a lot of that. You're right. Little George did a lot of that as far as words. And I think Paul did also.
Mississippi, she's calling my name. Catfish are jumping, that paddle wheel bumping. Black water keep rolling on fast, just the same.
Oh, black water keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me? Yeah, keep on shining your light. Gonna make everything great. Mama gonna make everything alright. And I ain't got no worries, cause I ain't in no hurry. Some funky Dixieland and dance a honky tonk, and I'll be buying everybody drinks all around.
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
by the hand. Pretty mama, come and dance with your daddy all night long.
I'd like to hear some funky Dixieland. Pretty mama, come and take me by the hand.
By the hand, take me by the hand. Pretty mama, come and dance with your daddy all night long.
I'd like to hear some funky Dixieland. Pretty mama, come and take me by the hand.
By the hand, take me by the hand. Pretty mama, come and dance with your daddy all night long.
I'd like to hear some funky Dixieland. Pretty mama, come and take me by the hand.
Come on, baby. Take me by the hand. Pretty mama, come and dance with your daddy all night long.
I'd like to hear some funky Dixieland. Pretty mama, come and take me by the hand.
The Doobie Brothers with the song Black Water. It was an album track off of Vices and Habits, played by the burgeoning FM progressive rock stations then. Never intended by the band's record company to be a focus track, it had actually been the B-side to Another Park, Another Sunday single 8 months earlier. And Black Water ended up being the Doobie Brothers' first number one song at Top 40 and selling over 1 million copies of the Vices Habits album. Coming up next, Doobie Brothers singer, songwriter, guitarist Pat Simmons joins us in the studio for the 45th anniversary of Stampede.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Mike Hossack of the Doobie Brothers.
And I'm Tom Johnston of the Doobies with Redbeard.
Oh, gee, it's nice to hear Doobie drummer Mike Hossack's voice. We lost that gentle giant in 2012. However, one founding member has played on every Doobie Brothers album and tour for 50 years now. That's a mind-boggling achievement. He is Pat Simmons. And Pat told me how Black Water's surprise success gave the Doobie Brothers some creative license on their next album, Stampede.
For us at that time, we were just plain lucky. A lot of producers would have said, no way, you guys, let's, you know, don't bore us, get to the chorus. Crank out those hits. And the producer at that time said, you know, let's do some arrangements. You know, you guys are good at arrangements, and let's do some fun real musical things. And he helped us as much. I think Ted Templeman had a lot to do with aspects of the band at any given time in the studio. Ted liked to help us to put a different face on things while every time we would go in, you know. We certainly had a sound. We certainly had at all the different eras of the band, but he kind of didn't want us to repeat ourselves. He felt the same way we did. We had elements of the music that would always be there and that we should never, you know, let go of, but at the same time trying to find some new direction of being able to go in and not go, you know, hey, let's try to just crank out those hits, you know. He said, you know, let's, you know, we got songs on here that are good radio songs or whatever, but let's do more. Let's always go a little further for things. And I think that's the mark of a good producer, really, is to help the band be more than just, you know, the same thing they were the last time. And the producer has to help point you in a progressive direction.
Released in April 1975, leading off the album Stampede, the Doobie Brothers with the Jack Kerouac On the Road song, Neil's Fandango. Over their 5 decades, the Doobies have included over a dozen musicians, and having played with all of them, Pat Simmons is uniquely qualified to assess the net effect.
I think, you know, we all have wide tastes in music. I think that's probably what's helped all of us. And in a certain sense, I think we've gone towards a direction that maybe we think we're familiar with, you know. In other words, you know, we all see ourselves in this band, I think, probably in a different light as say, we might see ourselves in a band with Jeff Baxter or Mike McDonald or, you know, Cornelius Bumpus. You're playing with other people and you start to look to yourself and you go, well, gee, you know, what influences do I have that are going to cross over and that we can meld and make a good statement that everybody will feel good about and have and be able to, you know, make a convincing musical statement. So you start to look for things, for ways that you can enhance whatever's going on, I think. I think that's the way all musicians really work. Who really care and really want to make a good thing. You know, guys can say, you know, I just can't come up with anything. And I'll be honest with you, I've been that way myself sometimes in the studio or whatever. I'll just say, you know, I hear the song, I can't come up with a part. You guys maybe should cut the track yourselves without me and let me listen to it for a while. Sometimes then I'll step back and I see something that I can add to it that'll make it work. Or sometimes I just say, I think it sounds fine just the way it is. And, you know, if I can sing some backgrounds or, you know, do some hand claps or whatever to make it work, I would be happy to contribute that much. I think that's kind of the attitude, or has been the attitude, of the people in this band at given times when they've had to assume different roles.
Rock me real wild. Oh, it's not.
That song had been a Motown hit for Kim Weston, written by the juggernaut writing team of Holland, Dozier, Holland, and the Doobie Brothers' sweeping, energetic take made it a number 11 in spring 1975. The band worked really hard with their production team, with arrangements, orchestration, and several big-name guest musicians to make the album Stampede the best-sounding Doobie Brothers album to date. But the nonstop grind of one-nighters in concert, stopping only long enough to record the next album for 5 long years in a row, was starting to create the stress fractures in the foundation of the band. Here's Tom Johnston.
Over 200 gigs a year, and you don't see much of your house, home, or anybody else that you might care about when you tour like that. And it burned a lot of people out. I was one of them. I quit in 77 with a bleeding ulcer and everything else, and I wanted to do a solo album, but that was one of the causes, and I was just burnt. I was burnt toast, so I needed to quit. I needed to just distance myself from all that for a while and be a little lower speed and get healthy, and which I did. I spent a while getting healthy, and then I did this solo album in 79, the first one, and another one in 80, or 81, excuse me. But the road factor can be a burnout on anybody. I don't care who it is.
The days grow short, the nights are gone. Since you were here, I can't go on. I cried for you to no avail. Now my life runs cold when the night winds wail. But I cheat the hangman,
cheated him many times before.
Then I close the hours, turn sweet lips to sighs. I cheat the hangman.
And even when life has flown away,
I never kiss the hangman. The rain that fell upon my stone, like tears you cry, I shed alone. I walk the night, I cannot sleep. The love you spend, you cannot reap. But I cheat the hangman,
cheated him many times before.
The bell tolls the hour, has turned sweet lips to sour. Yes, I cheat the hangman, and even when life has flown away, I leave a kiss behind. The glow of love will shine, lighted windows stare at the stranger there returning home. Only lighted windows stare at the lonely stranger there. Only lighted windows stare at the lonely stranger there returning.
Pat Simmons' epic I Cheat the Hangman from the Doobie Brothers' April 1975 album Stampede. So Tom Johnston took medical leave permanently from the Doobie Brothers after recording the Stampede album. It would be 10 long years before a remarkable thing happened. The whole band had been on hiatus for 5 years through the mid-80s when the late Doobie drummer Keith Knudsen was approached. Fellow drummer, the late Mike Hossick, picks up the story with Tom Johnston in the studio.
The single event that that got us all really thinking about it was when Keith was asked by Vietnam Veterans Aid Foundation in Los Angeles to see if the band would do something to raise some money for Vietnam vets. And Keith put a lot of effort into organizing that show, and it eventually ended up being all 12 members of the group. Probably the best band I ever played with. I have to say, it was a phenomenal thing to walk out on stage with four drummers, a percussionist, four guitar players, a couple of keyboard players, you know, tie on bass, and all those voices. It was like we could reproduce the record live on stage with those people. Mm. And it was like, it wasn't like going out to do a show. It's like a gang assaulting a stage. You know? It was just so much fun. And so, you know, we put a lot of time and effort into organizing that. I mean, if you can, you know, you can probably imagine the logistics and organizing, you know, a project like that. So after that much effort, we decided to do Vietnam Veterans Aid Foundation, Stanford Children's Hospital fundraiser, and we did a Little Sisters of the Poor. We raised close to $1 million or maybe a little more for all three total. It was 87. It was the
summer of 87.
Started in May, right? May and June.
End of May.
May and June of 87, and that was 10 shows. After we had done the fundraisers, we all decided,
We did. Our first show was San Diego, and that's where everybody got their mind fixed for what we were going to be expecting the rest of the time, because we went on stage and nobody was expecting what happened, which is everybody stood up and went nuts for about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Everybody's looking around at each other like, whoa.
It was a pretty splendid welcome back, I tell you. There were some tears that night.
You know, nobody expected that, I don't think.
Yeah.
That made it nice.
They wouldn't let us play for first five or six minutes. Just screaming.
Before we played enough.
We just walked on stage. They screamed at the top of their lungs for a good solid 5 minutes.
A good crowd in San Diego.
You couldn't hear us talk. That was
interesting.
It was outrageous.
No less than the world's leading concert promoter then, the late Bill Graham, knew that communism's wall on Russia and the Soviet bloc countries of Eastern Europe was teetering then too. Not from missiles and guns, but from rock and roll and blue jeans. Again, Mike Hossick and Tom Johnston of the Doobie Brothers.
We went to Moscow. Bill Graham called us up and asked if we'd like to do the first ever free concert in Russia, in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
It was Carlos,
Santana,
Bonnie Raitt,
James Taylor. I think that's it from the U.S. side.
And there was a Russian rock band called Autograph. Mm-hmm. And a couple of ethnic...
They had folk dancers, they had a jazz band.
Russian groups.
I was impressed by, that's the only word I can think of, by the difference in people. And yet at the same time, you know, people are people no matter where you go, but just the way they think, because that's the way they've been brought up, you know. And I think about that sometimes when I'm here, I mean, which is most of the time, but how different people think in different parts of the world, be it Africa or be it Russia or be it South America or whatever, you know. We're all just people, and people have a tendency to forget that, and there's so many people, and you're just one of them. Over there, it's kind of like almost like a third world country, because the population gets 10% of the economy as far as that goes. The rest of it basically goes for military and research, scientific, things of that nature. So there's a long waiting line for everything, be it food or a place to live, like apartments. There's a six-month waiting list. Kind of funky. We stayed in a hotel. It was only 7 years old. It was made for the Moscow Olympics that we didn't show up for. And that thing was already screwed up. And I'm not putting anybody down. I'm just saying I don't think they went out of their way to build this thing. Let's put it that way.
And, well, there's no incentive to excel.
No, there really isn't. I think people over there have accepted the way things are until recently, and that's been changing. And I think they've opened the door. They can't ever close again once they've allowed bands to come in and people with big names to come in and play. And that was the first ever outside concert. They've had inside concerts with Chicago and people like that. they never had an outdoor to-do like that, which reminded me an awful lot of like 1967 or 68, you know, the Summer of Love or something. It really did, because here was all these people coming from this peace walk, right, from Leningrad to Moscow, about half American and half Soviets, and there was just like a prevailing attitude was something like a bean, or, you know, I mean, much larger, but it's this huge soccer field. It was massive, and we filled up, I guess, probably a third of it, but it was right straight out. There's probably about 100,000, I don't know if it's that many, but a lot of people, let's put it that way. It looked like a lot of people. And then there was still plenty of space left over, I mean, if they wanted to really do it. The tickets were dispersed in such a fashion that I think party members' kids got the first crack at them. They went out and gave some to the factory workers. And it's not like you can go up and pay and get in. It's like that's how you got the tickets.
They did have that live or that rebroadcast right in,
yeah, in
downtown
Red Square.
Moscow on a huge
video screen.
They broadcast the show.
Mm-hmm.
And from I didn't see it because we were playing, but from what I understand, there were thousands of people actually dancing in the streets in Moscow.
Showtime put that up, didn't they?
Yeah.
I think they did. So it would have been good clarity or whatever you want to say on the picture and sound for that matter. But at the same time, we went to places like Gorky Park, and, you know, you could be anywhere. You could be anywhere USA walking in there. I mean, it's a big, lovely park with a lake, people paddling around or rowing around on it in some rowboats. And
yeah,
there's rides, and there's people walking around eating ice cream and stuff. And so, you know,
there's
some things that are the same no matter where you go in the world, and then some things are radically different, like what you can say, and getting out of the country freely is something people don't really do. And I was told by my interpreter, you don't talk about two things, sex and politics. Mm-hmm. And so she even got upset when we were talking to her about hamburgers. She didn't know what that was. But overall, I'm glad I went. I wouldn't want to stay there, but I was glad I went. We'll be right back.
Johnston's Music Man from the Doobie Brothers Stampede in April 1975. After being snubbed for 25 years, April 2020 was when the Doobie Brothers at long last were to be honored with induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Now, with the induction ceremonies postponed until November, the band and their long-suffering fans will have to wait just a little bit longer. It gives me the opportunity, then, to point out a long-standing tradition within the band that doesn't get much publicity. Here's Pat Simmons of the Doobie Brothers in the studio.
As we toured, we used to visit hospitals all the time. We just, you know, take coming in and out of town. We'd go see usually the kids section of the hospital and, you know, take pictures over and T-shirts and stuff, give to the kids. One Christmas, you know, usually spend Christmas in the, at home in the Bay Area. Somebody said, you know, here we are at home. Why don't we go visit a hospital? And we thought, Children's Hospital at Stanford. It's like the happening Children's Hospital in the Bay Area here. San Francisco State also has an excellent Children's Hospital, but Stanford Children's Hospital, brand new, endowed by the Hewlett-Packard Corporation. Lucille Packard was the principal founder of the hospital. It's named after her. And we went in and were so touched by the kids and what was going on there, and so impressed with the hospital itself and just, you know, what they're doing to save lives there, that we just said, hey, let's park here a good part of the year and do things with the hospital, and especially continue this tradition and do what we can to bring attention to what they're trying to do there. And so that's kind of our little pet thing. I would say maybe it's more my pet thing. I talk everybody else into doing it, but now it's getting to be, they're starting to get into it, I think, the rest of the band. So anyhow, that's been a tradition, and I hope will remain a tradition as long as we have the ability to help out there.
Bye.
I'm Redbeard, congratulating the Doobie Brothers for 50 years they've been together. We'll be back in the studio. You better believe it.